a bit of that, you know, we bring up many times, so the kind of the turning of the screw of interpretation, where it's like you get this very surface reading, which really is almost like just kind of more or less basic information, Sparks notes, right? And then, you know, and then you go a little bit deeper and you get a little bit more into it. And then maybe you engage with secondary literature that's like, that's actually academic and important in and of itself, as an actual aid for like, for continuing to turn the interpretive process. And that's like a huge part of what the education is, and why it's unfortunate that so many, like we were talking about earlier, so many people sort of leave behind their academic, particularly academic artistic interests and stuff, because that growth of understanding, I don't think ever really stops, right? Like it, you can always, especially when we're dealing with people who have a lot to say in interesting or complex ways or unique ways or whatever, that like it can be a life, obviously it could be a lifelong journey understanding Wittgenstein, who you understand or and how you understand it versus when you started versus 10, 20, 30, 40 years later, could just look completely different, right? You'll have a completely different relationship.
Yeah, I think you ended it perfectly, and it has to do with that relationship, right? Like a lot of my encounter with Wittgenstein is in this like kind of fragmentary way. I have read like, you know, the Tractatus and the Philosophical Investigations, but he has lots of journals and notebooks and things that more learned Wittgensteinians are just kind of like, I'm getting through like filter feeding in a way. But in any case, I've encountered a fragment where Wittgenstein said that, you know, the value or the seriousness or the value of doing philosophy is that it is work on oneself, right? In a certain way, yes, you're absolutely correct that when one studies, like, say, someone like Wittgenstein, or I get this sense even with, like, studying Arendt, or I can pick anyone, right? Like, when I am studying a particular philosopher, it's almost like I'm kind of developing a relationship with them. Like, when I feel like I'm going to pick up a new text, the sort of experience of that, of like trying to bring myself to the commitment of reading someone, like I want to read Kant's Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics, but the thing stopping me isn't necessarily like, oh, this is going to be difficult or anything like that, because the Prolegomena is, as far as Kant goes, it's quite short, and he's trying to be clear. So it's not a difficult text. It would be, you know, it would take some effort. But the thing that sort of stops me is like, am I ready to have a relationship with Kant in a way, right? Like, am I ready to commit myself to trying to understand the world in the way that Kant does? Like, am I willing to sit down and really like listen to Kant and to take him seriously? And that is much more difficult, but it's a lot more, I think it's a lot more of what philosophers are actually doing when they are taking a text seriously and they're trying to understand it, is they're trying to put themselves in that philosopher's shoes, right?
Speaking of relationships, can I bring up something? Well, we've also been talking about some famous philosophers, so maybe I'll bring up fame a little bit. My quandary for this episode, I know it's what we usually, for our listeners are probably fully aware, we do the quandary stuff at the beginning, but we've just been having a chat. It's the end of the year. But I did have one that's something I've been kind of thinking about a little bit lately. And I saw, there's actually a quote. Now, I want to say this quote came from a Reddit comment. So it's not a real, it is a real quote, but but it got me thinking a little bit. Someone said the dark side of fame is that your own life escapes you. So I've been thinking about, like, just very loosely over the Christmas break, thinking about, you know, the nature of fame a little bit. My partner and I, we watched the P. Diddy documentary. Moving on to current, going from Wittgenstein to P. Diddy. But we watched that, and there was some other I think, you know, just you're just kind of like watching dumb Netflix content or whatever. I think we watched it, something on Taylor Swift.
I have this, well. I have a holiday tradition where when I go home, it's the only time of the year where I get exposed to advertisements because my parents don't have any kind of ad blocking, whereas I'm just like a fortress. So it's like this interesting, I have like this anthropological kind of feel going out to my parents, so I'm like looking at advertisements, and you know, as a media studies guy, I can't get enough of it.
Well, and like, who advertises themselves more, or who is advertised more than famous people, really? But what I thought, I like going back to that what that person said, the dark side of fame is that your own life escapes you. We live in an era, fame and notoriety has been a big thing for a long time, but obviously it's really exploded with the advent of mass media. So particularly with the advent of typographic media and stuff, right? Like where, because like prior to that, you know, who would be famous or well-known? It's like, can you even say that someone was famous in the Middle Ages? Like, probably in a way, but they're not, you know, there's no advertisements for them. People aren't, you know, and not everybody doesn't have their book or their pamphlet or their poster up on their wall or whatever, right?
Like, yeah, it's just to interrupt very quickly, like, it's interesting that even in the, so, like, in the ancient world, you would certainly have, like, canonical names, but it seems like they would always be organized in a certain way. So like if we think back into the pre-Socratics, you had this concept of like the seven sages, but the interesting thing is that the names like are kind of loose. It's not like a set definite list of seven names. Like Thales was usually one of them, but then you also had like Bias and Solon and stuff like that. Some would drop in, some would drop out, so but you wouldn't ever call any of them famous. It's not the same phenomenon, right? Like, and in the Middle Ages, you wouldn't call Jesus famous, right? He's not famous. The phenomena that we are talking about, fame, is not what Jesus was in the Middle Ages, right? He's, everyone knows, like, obviously it's taken for granted that everyone knows who Jesus was and stuff like that. But it's not the same thing, you know.
Well, I've heard someone say before that fame, or what they said, but basically fame is like the world of famous people or Hollywood or whatever. I mean, it was Hollywood is modern mythology, right? Where it's a totally different relationship, exactly like you're saying. Now, one of the big things too is like, so getting back to that, like obviously in ancient times there would be famous people, there'd be names that everyone knew. Most of those names would be of people or entities that either never really existed or existed in some very loose form, and their story has become something widespread and far outside of them. And in almost every case, they are dead by the time everybody knows their name. And that makes sense with the way information travels and the speed of things, the ancient world and stuff like that. But I was also thinking about fame in the sense of like a phenomenal experience from the inside. Now, obviously, I can't know what that's like because I'm not famous. I don't really want to be. But it seems to me like, again, like you're light, you lose your own grasp of your life. You, like a famous person, it would seem to me become, and I've certainly heard many famous people talk about this. You know, you're still just an individual person, but you're also not anymore because you now, large parts of society have some sort of parasocial relationship with an image of you that is very much not who you are. Right. It's your profile self. Right. Like it's a kind of like a profile self on steroids. We've talked about, you know, in terms of media profiles and profilicity and stuff like that on the show before. But yeah, you have this sort of profile self. But at the same time, that profile self is your living. And I think in a lot of ways, it's your own self-understanding. And it's kind of creates this like vicious little feedback loop where on the one hand, you're still just like a mortal person who happens to be really good at, maybe you're some sort of artist or a entertainer. Maybe you're just famous for the sake of being famous. You're good at notoriety, right? But you also have to have some sort of relationship with the way that everybody else sees you, right? And I think for a lot of people, this can be very, for a lot of famous people, this can either be very disconcerting, right? Like there's a great distance between who they see themselves as and how they're viewed by the public, or the two sort of blend, like the profile, the famous self takes over, right? And the famous individual can no longer see outside of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think of, like, immediately the thing that I think about is John Berger's analysis of this, when he talks about how he talks about the role of glamour in modern advertising, right? And the way that advertisements are these glamorous fantasy worlds that exist purely to create envy, because that's what glamour is. Glamour is the state of being envied. And the reason that glamour comes with this glitz and glam and can only be put in this fantasy world is because it has to be impossible, right? That's precisely what is envied, is I can't have what you have. You know, you're in this advertisement. You know, it was like the 70s at the time, so there would be like smoking advertisements, but you know, you're smoking in the middle of a desert oasis and life is great and beautiful and you can leave and go as you please and stuff like that. There's no like there's no difficulty getting here. There's no like we didn't have to like sign on like a political you know, anything like political. We didn't have to arrange this at all. This was just like, this is just something that you could have if you buy this cigarette, right? So there's something about envy that has to be constructed about a person. If we just advertised that a person was like a mundane person, it's interesting, right? Like I think before I would have thought like, okay, well, you know, if you just like advertise that, you know, we all live like mundane lives, then that mundanity would just come across. But there's actually something about advertising per se. Like there's just a medial feature of advertising that makes it glamorous. And that's because they get to be that in public, but I don't, right? Like I noticed this with like advertisements where it's like people get to be like shirtless in public, but it's like, well, or like, you know, like naked in public, except for like, you know, a fabric or whatever. Where it's like, well, if I did that in public, I would be arrested for, you know, public indecency, you know, but an advertisement gets to do this. It's impossible, right? It's constructing this envious, or it's constructing this world that's impossible to exist in. And it's right there. It's not actually a feature of any fantasy world. It's built into the advertisement. That image is up there. But if I were that image, it would be no go, right? So it has to be something about the medium itself. So I don't think that even, and this is like the illusion of reality TV, right? Like even if we, you know, like just like all these shows where famous people get camera crews following their family around trying to humanize them. And, it, you know, they're just like making their breakfast or they're getting their coffee or whatever and they're going to work. Okay, well, there's actually something about the process of advertising, I guess that's what it is, of advertising it that turns the mundanity into something enviable, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah, 100%. And I think you brought up something else that was really interesting with this phenomenon, which is like the impossibility of what's being kind of offered, right? Like it's all obviously constructed. It's media. It's a media reinterpretation. We've talked about this many times before and what like that, you know, what that can look like. And especially nowadays with the way media works, I think its ability for nuance and its distance from reality is ever, you know, ever increasing. But it's also like, it's interesting to see how famous individuals themselves react to, well, but not just that, but also like this own impossible, well, it's part of it, which is the impossibility, which is, you know, like I was saying earlier, it seems like some people who gain fame and notoriety, they distance themselves further and further, and some people lean into it and really cross over. But what they're crossing over with is that is the impossible self. It's the media self. It's the profile. It's the thing that everybody sees. They might, and it's like, on the one hand, it is you if you're that person, but it's also obviously not. And you end up getting a lot of these very, so here's an example. Like I mentioned, the P. Diddy documentary we watched. This was the interesting thing about the documentary. Now, taking for sake of argument that it's, you know, relatively accurate, was basically as this individual got more and more famous, they just more and more believed that they could do whatever they want, right? That they developed like a very severe God complex. Obviously, any sort of complex like that is divorced from reality, right? Like that's not, and you see it all the time with like, it's when you get to know, or I shouldn't say get to know, look at my own parasocial relationships coming through. But when you see maybe what you think is more candid or off the cuff stuff with a lot of famous people, they seem kind of weird and like out there and like kind of alien. And I think that it's, you know, I think that a lot of that has to do with individuals basically sort of losing their sense of self, their sense of reality in their own momentary fame. Because all that's the other thing is fame is extreme, especially we're talking about kind of media fame people. So that's what we're thinking about. It's very momentary, right? And even if someone like lives for a long time and is famous their whole lives, famous people are forgot very quickly once they pass on too. Like who, like does anybody remember who the biggest silent movie star was? Any of our listeners know who he or she was? Because they were huge at the time. Everybody knew their name. But, you know, obviously most are, you know, famous people or whoever are forgotten. It might have been someone like Buster Keaton. I'm thinking Charlie Chaplin did stuff in moved into the talkies. There's an image of this woman I have in my head who was really, she was an actress, obviously, silent movie era. I can't remember her name. But again, it's someone who was very, very famous at the time. But you know, was, you know, time kind of, things move on. And especially with one of the contexts of media, right? If your fame is tied to a particular vehicles of media, types of media, and that shifts or is it goes out of fashion or use as much or whatever. Yeah. Well, so do you.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. I mean, this ties in really well with what I wanted to say about kind of the irreality of oneself when you become famous in that way. And I do think it actually has a little bit to do with like that sort of like media obsolescence. Like that's one phenomena of it as well, is like when you get lodged as like this nodal point in this media landscape, like silent film, and then all of a sudden silent film is made obsolete by the talkies, right? Well, I mean, you just kind of go by the wayside because you've been lodged in that, like that, since that ecosystem is supported by you, well, you're just going to go with the ecosystem, right?
And this has become even more apparent with the context of the way both modern media platforms shift, but also how they internally change and shift. So it's like you and I both, like we could take probably examples that are more recent, but like think about YouTube, and I'm sure you and I both grew up in the time, early, late 2000s and early 2010s when YouTube really blew up, lots of famous YouTubers, all this kind of stuff. Most of those YouTubers have more or less like fallen off. Like some of them are still around kind of doing stuff and not, it's not like, you know, it's, they haven't been completely forgotten, but a lot of them have sort of been relegated to the dustbins of internet history. And a lot of that has to do with not just like the media, the media platform changing, but how the media platform is used and what is popular and interesting within the context of that platform that sort of makes people sort of pass away. And that's, those cycles happen very quickly now, obviously.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? I mean, it goes to a thought that I've kind of had about the way that platforms might differ from media, insofar as platforms are kind of constructed by the people that are on them, whereas like a medium has more to do with like the particularities of the medium itself. So like with painting, as the medium and its practices shift, those are necessarily going to be tied to the people doing those practices. But for something like YouTube, like, you know, like 2010s era YouTubers and the people who are relevant in that, are, it's totally different, right? I mean, like, I haven't been paying attention to YouTube a lot as far as like who's big on YouTube anymore, but like the obvious, you know, big one is like someone like Mr. Beast or something. And the reason kind of in part has to do with like the way that Mr. Beast is, you know, the content that he's putting out and stuff like that. But it also is just like the fact that there are different people on YouTube and they're doing different things with those things. And that sort of generates like a different ecosystem, even within the same platform. But it doesn't have to do with like, because like YouTube is videos, sure. But it's not as if like the production of video has been changed in some medial way. Like now everyone's watching it in 3D or whatever. It has to do with the ecosystem of like how those things are distributed. And I think in particular now, because of the way that the internet has had to take on so many users, that it has had to resort to algorithms and the way that recommendation algorithms get videos to people, that has changed the, you know, that has changed who basically can be relevant on the platform. Whereas before, maybe it was had more to do with like the content and the way that the videos were shared was like either viral, like kind of virality, which is just like word of mouth on the internet. But now that algorithms have to, that's the thing, is they kind of have to exist. Like I was thinking of like, you know, I was like watching someone over the holidays like scroll through TikTok, and I was like, could you imagine TikTok in like the 90s on like you know, like a Yahoo style kind of like web list? It would be, it wouldn't be possible. Like you have to just have this like constant feed, and that feed has to be sorted in a certain way, right? The internet where you go and you find all the websites for repairing your car, and all, and Yahoo has like a sorted list of them, helpfully, you know, by popularity or quality or reviews or something like that. Like that's just not, that's not a thing that's possible anymore, or at least that's not a, that's not a possible avenue for relevance in the way that relevance matters, right? And this goes back to like the, with someone like P. Diddy, and he finds himself like wrapped up in this kind of world where there's a certain like structure to the reality of himself, because there's this alienating feeling, right, of him. He enters this kind of world where, how am I going to put this? I don't know how to put this, but essentially like it's a product of this like altered form of reality where the more he gets, like the more famous he gets, the more he's enmeshed in a separate kind of reality that that constructs that. But it's a reality divorced from our own, right? And that's where reality comes from.
It's a reality that becomes, well, it's a reality that isn't actually, it's, here's the thing, it's not actually, I wouldn't say it's actually divorced from our own in the sense of like these people still live in the real world. Like they're still walking around, you know, P.D.D.'s walking around, he's in jail, right? Like, you know, like it's all this kind of stuff. But it definitely lives out, and I would presume appears that way. And it does become a very isolated, little internalized world. I think, you know, I've always been, I find sometimes seeing famous people walk around as a very, like, just the way they carry themselves can be very odd. And are you familiar with headbinding? Yeah. So it was a thing that was done, and it was done in a lot of ancient cultures, and some Neolithic cultures and stuff, I believe, as well, where basically they would, you know, put pressure, you know, put constant pressure on a baby's skull to change the shape of the head. And this was usually presumed to be done to, in most cases, to important or elite status type people and groups. And so it was a way to signal, like, with a high degree of permanence, like, I'm someone special, I'm outside of the regular population, all that stuff. Now, there's all sorts of ways, and I kind of look at that, and I was thinking, then I look at famous people, and the one that obviously, honestly, comes to me are the kind of fame in the world, and it's more reflective of their own insular world and the way that they communicate and think about each other, is plastic surgery. And obviously, this is, like, you know, plastic surgery has been around for a long time. It's been a lot of commentary, but it's become very prevalent. In many cases, I think a lot of people would agree, a lot of laymen, people with average taste, regular taste, would say it looks bad. There's, we don't need to get into it, but there's specific surgeries that are very popular with, you know, even younger famous people right now. And that does translate down to the regular population. But it's also, to me, I see that and I think, is there a little bit of a sort of like, these people exist in a very insular world, and this is sort of seeping through in their own sort of subculture of, like, this is how you signal that you are this upper echelon status type person, is by messing up your face.
Whether it's aesthetically pleasing or not is almost besides the point, because all it has to functionally do is create that, like, social delineation, right?
The world that existed, that headbinding was a part of, was very different, and in many ways much more, I would say, much more closed in on itself. It's, you know, it's Neolithic, small cultures, right? You can't really, like, I'm sure from most cases of people experiencing that, like, things kind of seemed as they are. Whereas, unfortunately, now with the people who live in those sort of circles and are doing those sorts of things, they are riding, in most cases, on some momentary talent or slice of fame, and constantly also exposed to alternative views, or have the potential to be exposed to very alternative views that would really undercut very permanent decisions that they are making to themselves.
Yeah, that is interesting, because the sort of, I mean, it makes sense. It almost goes back to just like the headbinding itself, right? Which is very permanent. It instantiates this sort of strict and lasting social division. But social divisions now are quite, you know, quite lucid and even fluid as far as, like, what kind of social capital is worth what now, you know?
It's absolutely the case. You know, like, it's, we live in a more, in some, I would, in many ways, a more complex world. But what that also means is that things are much more deconstructible, right? And it's, you can't, and I think, to kind of end off on this, if an interesting tangent that we've come down on fame and media and stuff, either many people will be faced with having made a grave mistake for ends that were not worthwhile, as we come back to P. Diddy and many other people, or you end up coping by creating an extremely, basically, like, narcissistic self-involved personality.
You've been listening to The Canadian Philosophy Show, and thank you for listening.
You can find The Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. A program in New York City is helping train people for jobs in energy efficiency and changing their lives.
It gives people hope, and it gives people opportunity that they might not feel like they had.
Munir Smith graduated from the nonprofit Stacks and Jewels Building Automation Training Program. It's run in partnership with Henry Street Settlement, a social service agency on Manhattan's Lower East Side. Trainees learn how to install and operate technology that automates a building's lights and HVAC equipment, which can save a lot of energy. Michael Conway, co-founder of Stacks and Jewels, says the program goes beyond teaching skills. It also provides comprehensive support to students, some of whom struggle with poverty or homelessness.
If housing comes up, there's access to support there. If there's food or nutritional requirements, if there's transportation, if they need eyeglasses, if they need, you know, clothes that are appropriate for interviews.
So by helping trainees overcome barriers, the program provides a path to well-paying careers in energy efficiency.
And so, you know, I'm always looking at my classmates achieve great things. So it's a proud fraternity to be in.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Speak up.